J.W. Stevens, Imperial War Museum, accession number 11579-3, reel 1.
Brigadier Stevens, reel 1. Could you tell me, first of all, something about where you come from and your family background, please?
Well, I come from Wales. I was born in Roath, R-O-A-T-H, which is a part of, or not part of Cardiff, it's a suburb of Cardiff, I suppose. And my father was a ship owner, owned two ships, and made his money out of looking after them, things like that. And then we moved to Penarth, and eventually forget my name in a moment. Oh dear me! Anyway, up in the hills, and it was in the country. And when I was still a boy, and I used to wander around there.
How did you come to join the army then?
Well, I went to school at Blundell's in Devon, and my father was a businessman, of course, been looking after ships and things like that. And I didn't want to become a businessman, and I'd always, my eldest brother, who was joined the army on the first day of the 1914 war, I was the youngest of a family of six. I had two brothers and three sisters, and they're all much older than I was. I was an afterthought, I think. So he joined the actual army and went into the HSC on the first day of the 1418 war. And so I'd been brought up during the 1418 war and so on. And he got the first OB, one amongst the first OBs that were given out by Lloyd George and so on, which is now in the in the HSC Museum. I presented it to them when he died. He's dead now. And so on. My second brother was a very ardent territorial service, and he was in the 1st Monmouthshire Regiment, which is a rifle regiment, and so on. So I'd been brought up in semi-army sort of atmospheres. And I thought, well, in the army. And I always wanted to go to the Indian Army. So to the Indian Army I went, and I'd finished a Sandhurst.
What was the attraction of the Indian Army for you?
Well, it's you got much more fun if you had more fun in India than you did in England. I think you had everything you could think of. There was good. I was first whip to the Quetta Hounds for 3 years as a huntsman, and there was good shooting, and there was good fishing, and there was good everything you could think of. Polo in my regiment. In the second Gurkhas, first-class polo, and so on. So you had all those things that you could do if you wanted to. And it was much more fun than playing around in Aldershot, I used to think. And I was offered the Welsh Guards when I was at Sandhurst by the adjutant, who was Boy Browning, General Sir Boy Browning, as he came, he's dead now. And I said, no, I didn't think I could afford that. I couldn't afford it anyway. Yeah, because the lowest amount of money you want if you went to the Guards was £500, which is now about £5,000 or more than that, God knows what. Anyway, I didn't want to go there, so I went to the Indian Army, and I'm very glad that I did. I had 18 years of it, you see, which I much enjoyed, almost to it.
Were you ever involved in frontier warfare in India before the war?
Oh, yes, indeed, yes, rather. I was on the frontier. I spent 3 years with the Frontier Militia, which, if you look behind me, you will see a picture on the right there, on the left of the thing, which is the Zope Militia, where you dressed when you were on duty, which you were on the frontier the whole time. Frontier Watch and Ward was one's job. And you dressed the same as the soldiers, the same as the Pathans dressed. You wore the same clothes as they did in the Pugri, and you can have a look at it when you get up, you can see it better. So I had 3 years of that, and I spoke Pashto. I was an interpreter in Pashto. And that sort of stuff, which I've forgotten now, mostly. But yes, I know a lot about the frontier. And I've served in it in battles up there too, just after the war started, actually, Tauchina and that part of the world.
Which particular operations on the frontier stick out in your mind most?
Well, the last one, I honestly don't know what it was called. It was a big frontier. We were chasing the Fakir of Ypres about the place. And I was with the 10th Gurkhas then, and I was adjutant. And we were stationed at Rusmak. And we went out after. We got into a bad battle the first night we were out with the, not the Gilzais, the Wazirs. And I remember that because this battle went on most of the night, and one of our pickets had been sent up a hill there, and there was one of the Sikh pickets was sent up a hill, and they were surrounded and broke and tried to run for the camp. This was night, and you should never do that in the frontier, because we could, and they all got cut up, the whole lot of them. And I had to go out the next morning with my company. In fact, the whole battalion went out to collect them, and they were all dead, stripped and cut up and all the rest of it, and were carried off and on. And we had quite a battle that night. And it was an unpleasant battle because we couldn't do anything about it, you see, in the dark. They shouldn't have run.
How can you explain the fact that they had disobeyed one of the fundamental principles of frontier war?
Because they weren't trained bad enough. They hadn't been trained properly, I think, probably. They were all youngish soldiers, I think. CO was up there with them in this picket. There were about 50 of them. He stayed with them and was killed and so on. But they were attacked by a large number of these wazirs. And it was too much for them, and they ran. Their training didn't keep them where they should have stayed, looking after their picket.
And none of them survived?
Yeah.
How big a unit was that was wiped out?
Well, the same 700, I suppose, 700-800 people.
A whole battalion?
No, just the picket. That was only about 50 men. The picket was about 50 men. The whole battalion was about 50. There was just this picket goes up from the battalion as they're going to camp, you see.
So it was a picket of 50 men that was wiped out?
That's about it, yes. Mm-hmm.
What do you remember about the performance of the Gurkhas, the 10th Gurkhas, in afterwards?
Well, they just went on as Gurkhas do. The Pathans were much more frightened of Gurkhas than they were of most soldiers. They don't like kukris, but what from anything else. And I don't know, I've been in attacks with them, and which we've always more or less defeated, who affected defeat who we were after. And they are very good frontier soldiers. The best I know, actually, I think.
What was the attitude of the Gurkhas towards the Pathans?
Well, they were just dushman, as they're called, enemies. D-U-S-H-M-A, and as enemies, they had to be slain. That's really what it came to.
So purely professional?
Oh, absolutely, yes. They themselves were Mohammedans, the Wazirs were, the Pathans were, and our people are Hindus, of course, which does make a difference. But I don't think it makes much difference to our men. That didn't come into it at all. No, you said, as you with the Japanese, we've got to kill these people, so we went and tried and killed them. Not very successfully able to do.
So the date of this setback to the Sikhs on the frontier must have been in 40-41, when you were with the 10th Gurkhas at Rasmak as adjutant.
That's right, yes.
Did you ever come close to catching the Fakir of Ypres?
Yes, we did. We never caught him, though. He didn't get caught. In fact, he never was caught. During my time, he always escaped somewhere or other. He had a great influence over these people, the Pathans.
What did you understand his grievance to be?
Well, just he didn't like the English part or anything else. It's the usual Pathans' grievance. They didn't really mind. When we weren't fighting them, one was very good friends with them. I did 3 years with a frontier corps, the militia. and all my troops were Bhutans, and I couldn't have had better troops apart from Gurkhas. One got on famously with them, but we weren't fighting them. And if they had turned upon you, or not the people I was serving with, but the other Bhutans had turned upon you, then these chaps went and fought them. They came from a different part of Waziristan to the people that we enlisted. And that was. But it's all what they call jihad these days, Mormonism, Christianity and all that sort of thing. That didn't really come into their minds at all. All they wanted was rifles. And if you lost your rifles, your name went right down the hill. And there it was, which we didn't do, at least we never did.
What kind of a place was Reisnach in those days?
It was very much a hill station. I forget the height of it, 10,000 or something like that. And it may not have been as high as that. It was a frontier station, isolated from, completely surrounded by country where the Bhutans lived. And you lived in the usual barracks, but you had a wall all around you, which was guarded every night, of course. Called a large sangha, in other words, S-A-N-G-A-R. And you went out showing the flag. And if you got shot up, then you had to do something about it. So you did whatever you had to do, fought the most of the time.
What did you think of the performance of the British civil authority in the area?
A difficult question. We always thought they were bloody awful, actually. But they weren't really. They did their best and were very good. One often thought, as somebody said, somebody was fighting a battle up there sometime I was there, where it was a Gurkha regiment. And they bumped off quite a lot of these chaps. And the silver chap came into their camp afterwards and said, it was a very good battle, wasn't it? He said, my men fought famously. And the CEO said, oh, I'm glad to hear that. The chap did the best. Oh, he said, I wasn't talking about the Gurkhas, I was talking about the Bhutans. That's quite a true story, actually. There you are. But they were very good, actually. One mustn't decry them. They were very good indeed.
Was the attitude in the Indian Army to these atrocities which the Pathans typically carried out if they had the opportunity?
You didn't really talk about it. It was part of your duty. They were ashamed of people, or rather they thought poor old Tom Smith had been bumped off or something like that. But as a professional soldier, you took it as your duty to do these things. And if people had to be killed, they had to be killed.
Did the political events that were taking place in India at the time have much impact on
yes.
you on the frontier?
Well, they could do, because you were told them what to do, you see. Either you attacked people or you remained in your camp or you did this, that and other. If the Bhutans were rising in any way at all, then you had to send a brigade, two brigades, for instance, out to go and conquer them and put them back in their place. In which case they went back to their tribes and you had a large gathering which the political agent took, speaking Pashto, of course. And they had so many rifles taken off them, or they were fined so much money and this sort of thing. And they said, right, we'll do that. And they did it, and then they waited for a few months and did the same thing again, by and large, something much the same. It was a thing that went continually on, you see, the whole time. It wasn't the beginning of a war or end of a war. It was just going on the whole time.
Did you come across this organisation of, I think they were called Red Shirts, of Ghaffar Khan,
no.
who was allied with Gandhi and the Congress
no.
Party?
No.
They weren't any kind of presence in your area?
No. They weren't up on the frontier at all, really. The tribesmen live on their own in tribal territory. The Waziris, the Masoods, the Gilzais, and so on and so forth, all live in their own areas. They're not really concerned with what's going on in India. Their job is entirely... Pathan once said to me, and I was speaking in Pashto to him, and I was across the Afghan border, And I said to him, look, you chaps must stop this business. I said, we've got the guns, we've got aeroplanes, we've got all these things that we can conquer you with if we want to. Yes, he said, Saab, but our chaps have no cinema to go to. That's quite true. That's a true remark, I can tell you. It took the place of the cinema. That's really what it comes to. Come on, let's go and beat him up. That's all it came to, really.
A bit of excitement.
Oh, yes, well, they loved it. They're very good, too. They're very good tribesmen. They're extremely good with a rifle. They take a lot of beating. It's mostly sniping, the whole thing. You sniped every night. Came to your tent and that sort of thing. But that was all part of the business. Didn't worry very much. And you didn't go after them at night time because that was asking for trouble.
Did air power mean very much to you on the frontier at that time?
Yes, could do. It could blow up villages and things, which is about all they could do. But they were always warned, these villages, before any aircraft was sent over. They were told to vacate them and take their children and women out, and then the aircraft would come and blow them up.
Do you remember any specific villages that were punished in that way?
It's a long way away. I do remember one. I haven't got my map here, so I can't tell you. It was where Ypres was supposed to be, but he wasn't. It was just outside Rasmuc. I remember sitting on the gunner's lawn there while they blew off their cannons at him. Drinking beer.
This was the aeroplanes shooting it up?
Yes. I've seen aeroplanes in action. They're dropping bombs. They're only small bombs for those days, you know. And if you could spot an enemy, you would call up an aircraft and say, there's some enemy over there, go and bomb them. And that's what one saw them doing. Wapitis, by chance, I think they were. I used to fly in them myself when I was in the Frontier Corps.
So the army found aeroplanes useful?
Oh, yes, yes.
Can you tell me about the 10th Gurkhas and where they were recruited from at that time?
Well, the 10th Gurkhas were recruited in Memu. This is supposed to be about being a prisoner of war, isn't it?
But if I could ask you about this
first, yes, right. So, yes, in Memu. In fact, I've got their regimental history downstairs. My own regiment is 100 and... It was born in 1815. The 10th Gurkhas were born in 1890. And they were born in Memu and thereafter moved up to Quetta. No, to a place just outside Darjeeling and then to Quetta. And there they remained ever since, until disbanded, until they became part of the British Army, which they are now, of course.
From which kind of caste background did they come?
Of what? Of
caste background.
Limbu and Rai. They were Limbus and Rais. And the rest of the Gurkha Brigade are Muggers and Gurungs. Is that what you wanted?
Yes.
Limbu and Rai, they're the Eastern Nepals, and the others are Western Nepals. Muggers and Gurungs.
Did they have any kind of different characteristics from Gurkhas in other regiments?
The Limbus and Rais were a little more excitable than the Muggers and Gurungs. But they're all excellent soldiers, and I wouldn't give you much. I wouldn't toss my hat in the air about either of them particularly. They're both very good soldiers and very good people to serve with.
What happened when the attack on Pearl Harbor came to you personally? Can you tell me your story from the beginning of the Pacific War?
I was sitting... When the attack on Pearl Harbor came, I was in Sungipatani, in Malaya, with the 18th Brigade, I think it was. And we had an American on the staff, and all I really remember is hearing that this attack had come off, And this American walking up and down saying, I've been waiting for this for many, many years. He was very pleased that it would bring America in, which of course it did. And then the Jap aircraft came across and I jumped into my first slip trench. At the beginning of the war, that was.
What position did you hold then?
I was staff captain to 18 Brigade, is it? I got it down in that thing.
28th Indian Infantry Brigade?
That's right, yes. Which consisted of the the second battalion of the 1st Gurkhas, 2nd battalion of the 2nd Gurkhas, and the 2nd battalion of the 9th Gurkhas. That was the brigade. Carbondale commanding.
Who commanding?
Carbondale. Brigadier Carbondale, C-A-R-P-E-N-D-A-L-E.
What measures were taken as soon as the Pacific War started, as far as your own unit was concerned?
Oh, this brigade?
Yes.
Well, we were a depot. And we moved out of Ypres up towards the north of Malaya in order to meet the Japanese, which we did, at north of Kuala Lipis. Well, we met the Japanese and then we were driven back again, of course, the whole way down to Singapore. Nothing very much, it's just it was a very unfortunate battle to fight in because it was retreating battle, and one was being defeated, which is not pleasant. And no chaos or anything like that, but we had to retreat every day. We had no aircraft, you see. All our aircraft, we had no aircraft at all. The Japanese had the aircraft, we didn't have any. the Australian Air Force, which were up at Sungai Petani, retreated the moment they were bombed, and that was the end of our aircraft. So we had nobody to look after these Japanese who came and bombed you whenever they could. Caught me with my trousers down once too, and I had to double for it, but that was. But they came down low. They had nothing to interrupt them at all, except a ground fire and that sort of thing. An unpleasant battle. The whole thing was very unpleasant and very tiring. And
when you moved north to the frontier, where was brigade headquarters set up?
Well, brigade headquarters moved forward, and the troops were forward of brigade headquarters. They were wherever we moved, we were moving the whole time. I think we moved practically every day, probably forward in the first place, and then backwards afterwards.
Had you anticipated the tactics which the Japanese army employed?
Yes, I think so, because they couldn't really do anything else. By and large, we used the roads the whole time, and the Japanese came round us, by and large, or infiltrated us in some way or other, and which made us have to retire again. And the truth is that in fact, the troops that we were using, the British and Gurkha troops and Indian troops, had not been trained in this sort of battle at all, jungle fighting, not like the Japanese had. They knew far more about it than we did, I think. And so there it was. And nothing else to say. We held them up once or twice. We held them up at once at Slim River, where we had them in front of us, and it was fairly open ground. And there we knocked a lot. We punished them quite a bit one way or another, and so on. But mostly it was all jungle fighting.
Did the Japanese manifest any special fear towards the Gurkhas?
I don't know, because I was with the Gurkha Brigade and I never saw anyone else fighting except Gurkhas. But they came in themselves, the first attack, I remember, using these funny they invented something that sounded like bombs going off or rifles going off and that sort of thing. And you never know whether it was a rifle or not, and we weren't certain about that. You heard them all around you. And they weren't rifles at all. There was something they fired off that sounded like rifles or something exploding, which annoyed us a bit, but it didn't put us back in any particular way, I don't think.
What about the Malayan civilian population, the Malays and the Chinese? What was their attitude towards the fighting?
The Chinese were very good, what little I saw of them, and supported us. The Malays were very nice people, but I didn't see very much of them. I saw quite a bit of the Chinese when I was a prisoner, because they were on our side. In fact, they fed me once or twice when I was able to get something to eat. And they were very good. Malays, I don't know. I've served amongst them. I've never had anything to do with them from the point of view of military work and that sort of thing.
What did you feel about the performance of the Gurkha Brigade in the Battle for Malaya?
Well, they couldn't have done better. I mean, they fought when they were told to fight, and they retired when they had to retire. That's all you could do, really. You nearly got run over by the Japs every day. And you had to retire during the night. I remember driving with two nights running, or three nights running. And my brigadier always said that I should drive his station. We had station wagons, not jeeps. And I could hardly feel the wheel. I couldn't concentrate at all, which was no good. And one got very tired. And it was the next day you were in battle, using a rifle yourself, probably, as staff captain. Then my brigade major was killed, and I took over as a brigade major. But you didn't really know what to do because you had nothing to lay out, no camp to build, no nothing to attack. And so that was that. And then we were all I was sent back to Singapore, and was taken prisoner there.
Can you describe what you remember of the fall of Singapore?
Of the fall of Singapore?
Yes.
Yes, it were, well, it was overrun by the Japanese, of course, including Singapore itself. I can't really remember how it... I can't remember anything about it from that point of view. I'll tell you a story later on. Perhaps it might interest you. Not really, except being taken prisoner by the Japanese. I spent my last night not in Raffles Hotel, in the big shop in Singapore, and had my last meal there. And then I was captured.
A big shop?
Yes.
Like a department store?
Yeah, it was a department store. I don't remember the name. I can't remember it offhand. Anyway, it was the biggest department store in Singapore, a very nice one too. And then one was captured and marched off to Changi.
Whereabouts had you been in Singapore? Which specific places? Can you remember before you were captured?
Ipoh at all.
In Singapore Island?
That's on the island itself. Ipoh is Ipoh. We went straight to Ipoh when we went out as a brigade.
But on Singapore Island?
We weren't on Singapore Island. We went straight up into Malaya itself, you see, to Ipoh.
Can you describe your capture? What happened?
Very difficult, really, because you're all rounded up, you know. There's a bunch in one thing and another. I can tell you a bit more about it as a prisoner, I think, but one was rounded up as a bunch in Raffles Square, in the square there,